Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Buddham Dhammam Sangham Namassami. As I said, this is the first talk back here for a few months, but for those of you who aren't aware, during the rains the monasteries are still open and people come every day to offer the alms food and also to hear the Dharma teachings. And of course people often come to ask for guidance in times of difficulty. And recently, on a number of occasions, people have come to the monastery and asked for advice on what to do when bad karma is fruiting. And so tonight I'd like to talk about what we mean when we talk about bad karma fruiting, and what is the Buddhist approach to these ups and downs in life. We usually think about bad karma, particularly when big things happen to us that we don't like. So those two things are usually associated. Something rather big, but that we don't like. And so we assume that it is bad karma fruiting. The don't like part of it is very often what makes us define it as bad karma. And what we mean by bad karma very often is the fruits of bad karma. Karma means action, and karma vipaka is the fruit of that action. And what we're experiencing when we talk about bad karma is the fruit, the results of bad karma. And according to the teaching, this fruit can be produced because of something that we've thought, said or done intentionally in this life or in previous lifetimes. In Buddhism, we're not looking just at the narrow space of this one life. We're looking at having been in many lives before this one and having throughout those lifetimes, on many occasions, said or done things intentionally that were hurtful, harmful, selfish, unkind, and we've created, as a result, bad karma. And the Buddha defines bad karma as any intentional thought, speech or action which harms oneself in the present while we do it, or harms ourselves in the future, or harms anyone else in the present or in the future. And when we consider that we've all lived many, many lifetimes, we have to accept that we've all created bad karma in those lifetimes. We've all done things out of selfishness. We've all done things that were hurtful, as well as having done many good deeds, many acts of kindness, many acts of selflessness. Otherwise, we wouldn't be in the very favourable situation we're in, to have a human birth, to be relatively well, relatively happy, and in such good circumstances, to be living in a peaceful country, to living in a place where we have our needs pretty easily met, where we can practice our religion without persecution. All of these things are the results of our good actions in the past. So all of us have performed both wholesome and unwholesome actions, and all of us are the heirs of bad and good karma. And the thing that's difficult to come to terms with is when we're living a good life now, when we're keeping precepts, when we're trying to live in a kind and caring way, when we're even cultivating our mind in meditation, and bad things happen to us out of nowhere, that's when it becomes very difficult at times to accept this is bad karma fruiting. Now, if we're not a Buddhist, we might say this is just an accident. Things just happen like this. Or we might say it's God's will. Or we might have some other explanation. And karma is one of these aspects of the Buddha's teaching that the Buddha said one can't really get their mind around unless they are enlightened. And so it's not something that we have to believe, and it's not something that we have to try and fathom out for ourselves anytime something arises that we don't like and say this is bad karma because of. Because the way that our actions from the past play, interplay, interconnect, interact, modify each other, influence each other over lifetimes is beyond the capability of the ordinary mind to understand. So if we can't unravel it and we don't have to believe it, how do we use it? Well, first of all, we look at what does it mean when something unpleasant happens, something that I don't like. Coming to terms with it, to use it and to work with it. When something unpleasant happens, particularly when it happens out of the blue, we might look to blame someone or something. And we may not be able to find any particular person to blame. That can be very frustrating if we have to just accept what we've got. Ill health, for example. So we might get very depressed because we can't blame anyone for it and we can't work it out. Or we might look to get revenge on the person or the people or the situation that we think has produced our unhappy situation. Or we might use our unhappy situation as an excuse for not trying to do anything with it. Why should I? Look what happens. Even when I try to be good, bad things happen. So not being able to fathom it out and not having to believe it, we're stuck very often with not accepting what's happened to us and thinking that because this terrible thing has come into our life, it shows that we can't really make any progress. Because even trying to make progress, even doing all the right things, this sort of thing still happens. So it's useful, and I've always found it very useful, to go back to the time of the Buddha and to familiarize myself with some of the stories of some of the disciples at the time of the Buddha who came with all sorts of bad karma in their background and yet who were able to practice to become enlightened. We might say, well, they had the very good fortune to be around in the Buddha's time, so that was an extra advantage, and that's certainly true. But nonetheless, they had to work with the conditions in their own life. They had to work against their bad karma. So one of the stories which I like from the time of the Buddha is about one of the enlightened nuns. And she killed someone. She killed her husband before she became a homeless wanderer. And the story goes that she was the daughter of a very wealthy family. And one day she saw passing by in the street a robber who was on his way to the executioner's place. And she saw him and she fell in love with him immediately. And because she was from a very wealthy family, she persuaded her parents to pay a bribe to this man's guards so that he could be freed and he could become her husband. And so the parents, not wanting to disappoint their daughter, who was really determined to have her way, paid off the guards and brought this man into the household. And they were married in due course, and for a while things went well. But the man whose livelihood had been a robber was more interested in his wife's jewellery, in the jewels of the household, than in his wife. And so he was scheming to find a way to be able to get rid of his wife but keep the jewels and then be on his way. And so the story goes, and this is recounted in the commentaries, that one day he said to his wife, "When I was being led to my execution, I made a vow that if I could be freed, if I somehow could get away from being killed, that I would make an offering to the deity who is living in the area where the executions take place. So now that I've been saved, I'd like to fulfill that vow. So I'd like you to accompany me fully dressed in all your most precious jewellery so that we can go to this place together and fulfill this vow." And this is a very common practice in Asian countries particularly, to make vows and then to redeem them if you get what you want. And so together they went to make an offering to this deity. And as they climbed the hill to where the executions usually took place, the young man dismissed the servants of the household and said, "I want to go just with my wife to this place." And together they went to the top of the hill. And once they got there, the young man made his intentions very obvious. He wasn't interested in prolonging the marriage. He wasn't interested in his wife. All he wanted were her jewels. And so he determined that he was going to kill her on the spot to get what he wanted. And she said to him, "I've given my heart to you. So please, before you do what you must do, allow me to pay my respects to you as the person who's won my heart." And so in the traditional way, she went to circle him to pay her respects. And before she did that, she took off her jewelry, as he'd commanded, so that he could easily take them, wrapped them in her outer cloak. And as she circled him from the front, and then from behind, and then from the front again, she pushed him over the cliff, and he was the one who died. Now, having done that to save her life, she felt she could not go back to her household life, to her family. She'd been a fool. And so she left home on the spot and became a homeless wanderer. And she came upon a community of Jains, who were another order of spiritual seekers at the time of the Buddha. And she joined that community. And that community of spiritual practitioners, one of their practices was to undertake very stringent ascetic practices. And they asked her, what would she like to do? How far would she like to go in her ascetic practices? And she said she'd like to do the most extreme that there was. And so instead of shaving her head, they pulled out her hair to make her a homeless one. And it said that as a result of having her hair pulled out, that it never grew again in the way that it had before, but there were it was curly as it grew out. And so after that, she was always known as the curly one. So she spent the next few years in this community learning the practices that they pursued until she felt that she had mastered all of their teachings. And then she left them to become a free ranging homeless wanderer. And she was very good in debating, a very bright mind. And wherever she went, she would challenge whoever was the spiritual leader in that area to a debate. And she was always able to win every debate. She could never find anyone who knew more about life than she did. Until eventually she came to where the Buddha was staying. And in her usual way, she would put her stave, her rose apple stave, into the sand, and she would challenge whoever felt that they could better her in debate should come and knock over her stave, and that would be the challenge to engage in a contest. And at this particular time, Venerable Sariputta, the Buddha's chief disciple, came across this stave and asked the people there what was it for. Of course, he knew what it was for. And when they said, this is to challenge whoever wants to engage in debate with this female wanderer. And so Sariputta said, knock over the stave, I'll engage in a debate. And so the story goes that at an appointed time when there was a large audience, Venerable Sariputta engaged in debate with this woman whose name was Buddha. And Venerable Sariputta allowed her to ask him whatever questions she had in her mind. And he was able to answer them all to her satisfaction. This had never happened before, that she'd been able to find anyone who could answer her questions. And so she was very taken with this ascetic, with this bhikkhu. And then finally she'd come to the end of all her questions, and she said to him, now do you have any questions for me? And Venerable Sariputta asked her the question, what is the one? And she couldn't answer. She didn't know what he was asking. Of all the debates that she'd been in, she thought she'd heard all the questions, but that was one that she couldn't answer. And he was asking her, what is the one thing that all human beings need for survival. And that one thing is nutriment of material food. But she hadn't been able to come up with that answer, and so she admitted defeat. And having admitted defeat, she said, "I want to take refuge in you, Venerable Sir, in your teaching." And he said, "Don't take refuge in me, take refuge in the Buddha. He's the teacher." And so she went to where the Buddha was, and she paid respects to him, and she requested a teaching, the teaching in brief. And the teaching that the Buddha gave, her mind was so receptive for, that it said that she became enlightened on the spot. And the Buddha recognized that she had become enlightened just on hearing the teaching in brief, and he gave her the going forth. It's the only time that it's recorded in the Pali canon that a female was given the same going forth kambada as the monks. And so here was this person who became fully enlightened just on hearing the words of the Buddha, and spent the next 50 years, it said in her verses of enlightenment, roaming all over the country free because she was fully enlightened, receiving the alms food, receiving the support of the devoted lay disciples. Now this story, when we reflect on it, has several aspects to it which are worth reflecting on in the light of karma. First of all, here was this young woman who had the seed of enlightenment, the potential to become enlightened within that life itself. And in her ordinary household existence, there wasn't any indication that she was spiritually inclined. And in fact, she was used to enjoying a luxurious life. And in getting what she wanted, so much so that when she saw this young man, she had to have him. She had to have him at any cost. And she pursued what she wanted, and she got it. And then, having gotten what she wanted, she was faced with bitter disappointment. And with that bitter disappointment, she reacted in a very powerful way, taking the life of the person she'd fallen in love with. Now, all of those things happening in the mind and in the life of someone who had the potential to become enlightened in that very life. And having the bad karma to meet, to fall in love with someone who didn't love her, who wanted only to take advantage of her. To having the bad karma that someone actually wanted to kill her. Having the bad karma that she had to leave home and leave behind her family, her possessions, her circle of friends, everything that was dear to her. All of this happening in the life of someone who had the capacity to become enlightened in that very life itself. Having the bad karma to engage in ascetic practices that were so painful, so severe, and then wandering without a home until she came to where the Buddha was. This is what we need to reflect on when we're thinking about bad karma and whether or not it's an impediment to our progress on the spiritual path. Very often we can think, this bad karma that's fruiting must mean I'm a terrible person. This bad karma that's fruiting must mean that my practices aren't working. this bad karma that's fruiting must mean that I can't make it in this lifetime. And yet this is an example of someone who, with all of those things, all of those unfortunate things, all of those things that we don't like, and that's why we say it's bad karma fruiting, all of those things happening in her life, and yet still being able to fulfill her potential. So one of the things to reflect on, apart from the fact that bad karma is something that we all have and which we must all expect will fruit sometime or other, is that we're not always in a position to judge whether something is actually bad karma and a disadvantage, or is actually proving to be an advantage for us. Because we look at whatever is happening in our life from a very narrow perspective, especially when we're thinking about what I think is pleasant, or what I think I'm owed, what I think I should get as a result of the way I'm living my life. And sometimes what seems to be bad karma may be actually something good in disguise. An example from my own family. My father, as a young man, growing up in the time of the before the Second World War, in his family, TB was rife. And as he was growing up, he had, in his teenage years, he had an older brother who died when he was 18 from TB. And my father's mother also contracted TB and died from that. And in due course, my father also contracted TB. And one could say, well, isn't that very sad, all of that unfortunate, all those unfortunate things happening? And yet in my father's case, although he had experienced the loss of those who were close to him, and he even looked after his family members who were sick, the effect of having TB was that when the Second World War came and other young men were going off to fight, he was too sick, and he actually spent the war years in a sanitarium because he was suffering acutely at that time from TB. And during that time, one of the things that he had to develop was a lot of patience and a lot of steadfastness in the face of pain, because the treatment for TB in those days was very painful and required that people stay very still for long periods of time while their lungs were drained and while they endured very painful treatments to try to rid them of the disease. And so because of that, he developed a meditation practice. He developed the ability to lie very still and to relax his body and to separate his mind from his body so that he could endure the pain that went with the treatment. And as a result of that, he developed a very positive attitude towards life, in that he was able to take things in his stride and also developed the ability to relax, and to relax very deeply in a very short time and even in very stressful situations. His friends who went to war came back with very often very disturbed minds through what they'd experienced, and they lived with those very painful memories for 30, 40, 50 years. And my father didn't have that experience. And so what seemed to be bad karma fruiting to have this illness was actually a blessing in disguise. And very often when things happen in our life and we're looking at it from the perspective, nothing bad should ever happen to me, then we can get very distressed by what does happen. And we may fail to see that this thing is bringing us blessings in disguise. How often do we hear people say that because of the loss that they've suffered, or because of the illness that they've been through, they now look on life quite differently. They're not so shallow. They take more time for the important things. Relationships become more precious. This moment becomes more important. Things of the heart take precedence over material things. Not only this, sometimes when we experience something that seems terrible, we may not realise that we're just getting a small part of what it could have been if we hadn't been doing the practice that we've been doing. If we can only see what's in front of us and we don't realise what it could have been, then we can make what we're experiencing the worst thing that could ever possibly happen. And according to the way that karma works, not only is our bad karma operating, but our good karma is also operating. Our good karma has the capacity to modify the bad karma that fruits, to reduce its potency when it fruits in our life. So the thing that happens now may have been much worse if we hadn't been practicing, if we hadn't been doing all the things that we've been doing. So, for example, someone who comes to the monastery regularly recently had a bad fall. And you might say, well, fancy that happening to someone who's coming to the monastery regularly and doing dana and keeping precepts and all that sort of thing. But they had a bad fall, but that was it. They didn't break anything. No lasting damage was done. And we don't know how that kind of experience, that kind of situation could have been without the support of the good karma that we've been doing. And very often if people are able to take up what they experience in this light, then they can move on, come to terms with whatever it is that's happened in their life. So, for example, I was reading something about one of the people who was injured in the Bali bombing, someone who lost their arm. And their attitude was, well, I've still got my life and I can keep on living. So the loss of the arm is great. It's terrible. It's not something that we would want to happen, but it's not the end of the world. Now, this person may never have heard about good or bad karma, but when we hear about these kinds of stories, we can reflect on it in our own mind and see if we'd be able to do that, would we be able to accept what has happened? Would we be able to see what we've got rather than what we've lost? Would we be able to say, well, it was fortunate that I wasn't killed? Would we be able to move on? Now, some people naturally have this ability. They may have had this ability because of other things that they've experienced in this life. But when we're practicing the Buddhist path, this is how we should be reflecting for what comes into our life and for what goes out of our life. When good things come into our life, very often they come also unexpectedly. We get more than we bargained for many times, but we can take it for granted. We don't really pay attention. We don't really reflect on the fact that this is good karma fruiting. We might see that we've done something in this life, but we may also not be able to identify anything in particular that has made it possible for us to accomplish this or to get that or to be in this situation. So particularly when we're practicing, we need to keep our mind open to what karma is about. And in the present moment, how we do that is by understanding that we are making new karma right now with our reaction to what comes into our life, with the way that we deal with whatever it is that we're experiencing, whether we like it or not, whether the thing that we've got is what we want or what we don't want. How we deal with it now is where we make new karma. And how we deal with it now is going to produce the conditions that we're going to experience in the future. So we have the power to produce the conditions for happiness. If we don't understand that, if we aren't skillful, then we can repeat reactions which have produced unhappiness for us now, things that we don't like in our life now. These things come to us not as a punishment, but because we haven't understood clearly where we fit into the whole scheme of things and how we have the potential to create a life of goodness, of happiness, through skillful choices in the present moment. It doesn't mean that we won't be affected by what we experience if it's unpleasant. It's like having an acute illness. It comes for a short while. But if we get lost in resentment, in blame, in hatred, in jealousy, then it becomes like a chronic illness that dogs us, that we can't shake off, gets worse and worse, and affects more and more of our life. So the first step in being able to deal skillfully with what comes into our life, whether we call it the fruiting of bad karma or not, is to accept what's there. And with that acceptance, work with the conditions that are there. That doesn't mean that we say, I've got this terrible situation, there's nothing that I can do. It means that we don't add rejection, aversion, hatred to the situation that we're dealing with. This is particularly true when it's something that's with us 24 hours a day, like an illness. When it's a situation where something happens and it can't be reversed, such as when someone dies. If we push away that thing, then we keep it alive. We keep it alive in our own heart. And then because of that, we produce it again in the future. The first noble truth that the Buddha taught is that life is inherently unsatisfactory because we aren't in control. And that's one of the things that is hard to bear. So we can't control the nature of things, but we can learn to control our own reactions. That's the only place where we can exert control. But to get to that point takes effort, practice, repeated again and again and again. And in an interesting teaching which the Buddha gave, he said that it's not how much dukkha we have in our life that determines whether or not we're going to have slow realization of the truth or rapid realization of the truth. How much unpleasantness we have will determine whether or not it's pleasant progress or painful progress on the path, whether our experience of the path and our experience of life is pleasant or unpleasant. That will be determined by the amount of suffering that we have, the amount of attachment we have to our likes and dislikes. But whether we make fast progress or rapid progress, that's determined by how well we cultivate the factors that are necessary for enlightenment. And in this particular teaching, the Buddha said the five spiritual faculties, five qualities of mind which are required in order to develop this path, these five qualities are faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. And the Buddha said it's how well we develop those things which will determine whether our progress towards enlightenment is fast or slow. And so no matter what we've got in our life, it's not an impediment to making progress. If we use it to help us to develop those qualities. So faith is the confidence in the teaching. So when we hear about karma and we hear about cause and effect, as I sow, so shall I reap. If I think, speak and act with a pure mind, then happiness will follow. If I think, speak and act with an impure mind, a selfish mind, then unhappiness will follow. Do I have confidence in that? Try it out and see. Investigate it. Put some energy into investigating. Pay attention. Develop mindfulness. Use your experience as a way of investigating so that you strengthen your resolve. Take time for meditation. Only the mind developed in meditation is prepared to look at things that are unpleasant, prepared to look at them in a different way from how we've been used to, using the wisdom that we've heard about, applying that teaching to develop wisdom of our own. The Buddha said, this is the way we make progress on the path. So when things come into our life that we don't like, they become our working ground. And we may not be able to work out why this thing came, except that this is what happens to all human beings. Why it came right now, we may not be able to work out. What can I do with it? What can I learn from it? How can I act so as not to reproduce the sort of conditions that would produce this kind of experience? This is the way we make progress on the path to enlightenment. And when we talk about rapid progress, we're not talking about this year. We're talking maybe this lifetime, maybe not even this lifetime. But understanding the law of cause and effect, we know that however much we gain in this life will be put towards producing the conditions for our continued practice in future lives. So nothing is lost. And even if we have to deal with something that is painful throughout this life, it's not an impediment. In fact, it becomes part of the practice which can take us closer to the goal because of its very unpleasant nature. So these are some reflections on working with unpleasant karma, bad karma fruiting in our life. And I hope that this has been of benefit to you. May this the merit of this teaching help us all on our journey to enlightenment. May it help us all to attain Nibbana. If anyone has any questions, I'd be pleased to try to answer them. The question is that did this the woman who became a bhikkhuni and became enlightened, did she cancel out her unwholesome karma by joining the Jains and enduring the painful ascetic practices? And one of the things that we have to resist doing is to trying to work out how this bit goes with that bit and how this cancels out that bit. This is the kind of, we can have a simplistic approach and say, oh yes, that was paying back the debt that she had for taking the life of her husband, the fact that she had to endure this pain. But in fact, karma and its fruits are much more complex than that. And this is the danger when we look just at one life, when we look just at one set of circumstances, that we can't know fully what was what and what went with what. And when we look at our own life and we think, well, this isn't fair because I haven't done anything to deserve this in this life, we don't know what's playing out from previous lives and how that's the potential for that to fruit has been developed through something else that we've done in this life or in previous lives. So the story is really to show that people can go through a whole series of experiences and doesn't necessarily indicate that they're unable to fulfill the goal or reach the goal, and that even things that have been done which are very unskillful don't necessarily make it impossible. But to try and work out exactly how things cancel themselves out, that's something only a Buddha would be able to say. One of the things that is recommended and which is traditionally done when someone is experiencing a period of bad karma fruiting, and this might be things like one's house is burgled and then the car breaks down and then that someone gets sick and there's just one thing after the other, is that people will traditionally do go out of their way to do good karma at that time and to try to counteract the effects of the bad karma that's fruiting. And so they might make donations, or they might go and do acts of service, or they might take on practices of renunciation, all of these things to try to counteract the effects by producing good karma in their life. But one of the things that we should really reflect on, it particularly if we want to cultivate this path, is that it's no good waiting until those things are happening, because the very nature of the mind is to be very vulnerable at those times when we're facing difficulties. And very often when we're in the midst of difficulties, we don't have the strength of mind to go out and do those things. And so for those who are practicing and cultivating the path, we should be doing good karma as much as possible all the time, because the consequence of doing good karma is that it strengthens the mind. And that strength of mind is what enables us to accept what comes and to deal skillfully with it. So sometimes people will do lots of pujas and ask for help from the devas and do all sorts of things to try to counteract the effects of their bad karma. But we should be trying to produce the conditions for good karma as much as possible, and then that in itself will reduce the potential and reduce the potency of whatever bad karma we have already acquired in this life or in previous lives. Yes. So the question is, what is the teaching about killing in self-defense? And we have to, this is one of those situations where each one of us has to, in the moment, make a decision on how we're going to react to a particular situation. This is why it's necessary to keep on cultivating the path, so that in the moment one has sufficient clarity and strength to make whatever decision needs to be made. So in a situation where there's a lot of fear, for example, or a lot of aggression on our part, our response might be, I've got to kill this person to get out of this situation. Whereas if we are calm and practiced, we might find that there's an alternative even in that situation. I'm not saying that there will always be, and then that's a decision that we have to make at the time. But the martial arts, for example, like Aikido, the essence of that is not to harm your opponent, but to defend yourself. So if we practice an approach of that kind, then we might have quite different options available to us in any situation than someone whose strategy is just to get rid of whatever it is that's threatening me, and it doesn't matter how much it damages them. People have to obviously deal with very difficult situations in their life, and we can't give one blanket answer for everyone should do this in every situation. But we also can notice, or we can reflect particularly, that we don't want to make more bad karma. And if we really understand the consequences of our actions, and realise that we're going to receive the fruits of this action sometime, then that will also modify how we behave in this moment. The question is, what is the difference between someone who has the potential for enlightenment in this life compared to someone who doesn't have that potential? And is it the amount of bad karma that they're carrying? We all have the potential. It depends on what we do with what we've got. And this is where we can't really judge another person and say, there's no hope for you, don't bother trying, because we don't know what that person's karmic inheritance is. And we don't know the power of, for example, just path and fruit at any moment. So one of the consequences of becoming a stream winner, which is the first level of realization on the path to enlightenment, is that any unwholesome karma that would have taken that person to rebirth in a realm below the human realm, that karma can't fruit any longer. So that path and fruit moment, even though it's not full enlightenment, already removes the possibility of the fruiting of any of that other unwholesome karma. So we're really not in a position to judge. Someone might have strong negative karma in their karmic inheritance, and they might, for whatever circumstance, perform a tremendously huge act of good karma, and that carries more weight than the unwholesome karma. So one can't really make a blanket statement. The Buddha said that there are certain acts which mean that one will be unable to realize the path in this life, because one will be reborn in hell as a result of that action. So those actions are killing one's mother and killing one's father, wounding a Buddha, killing an Arahant, and creating a schism in the Sangha. So that would be bad karma, which would make it impossible for that person to realize enlightenment in that life, in the life when they perform that action. But in future lives, once that karma is exhausted, they could certainly attain enlightenment. But the important thing for us to understand is that we're making new karma in the present moment, and so that's why it's important that we accept what we have in our life and try to deal with it with equanimity and continue to produce the conditions for the fruiting of happiness in our life now. Right. It's just the question is in the relation to non-self, is karma personalised or is it just conditions? It's just conditions. It's not personalised in the sense that I'm a bad person because I did this and so many lifetimes ago, because with the teaching and the understanding of non-self, we understand that the me who's experiencing it is neither the same nor different, because there wasn't a self in the first place who committed the unwholesome karma. This is very difficult to get our minds around, but if we understand that this self, the mind, the body, but the mind particularly, is changing moment by moment by moment and is arising produced by conditions that we experience, and in turn acts to create or be part of the new conditions that are created, we see that the being who performed the action arose and passed away, and the being that's arising now, that's receiving the fruits of those actions, is a different being. And so it's a process. And because it's a process, we have the possibility of modifying the way that we play that out, or the way that it plays itself out. If there was a self who was inherently bad, or who had done that thing and that sustain that's going to be there forever, then we couldn't change. But because it's a process, and because with wisdom we can start to understand how to introduce new conditions which will modify the mind that is experiencing these things, then we can change and we can allow that karma to finish. This is not an easy subject to get our understanding around, and that's why I said that we don't have to just believe it. And if we try to work out in detail why this is happening now and what did I do or is this fair, then we can really give ourselves a hard time, really go crazy, the Buddha said. If we see in this moment that how we think, speak and act produces our experience in the next moment and the next moment and the next moment, then we start to see karma as it arises in the present moment, as it's produced in the present moment, and we start to see what is for our welfare and what is for our harm. And then we start to try to produce more and more of those things which lead to happiness. And as we do that, we reduce the potential of unwholesome karma to fruit because of the power of goodness. If one can't accept the concept of karma and rebirth, would that be detrimental to your practice? You don't have to accept anything in order to practice, but what you need to do is keep your eyes open. This is why it's important to develop these spiritual qualities. So the faith or the confidence is the willingness to at least have a look at this, not to reject it just because we can't understand it or because it doesn't really accord with what we've thought was the way things happen. So not to reject, but keep our mind open, and then apply energy and be mindful, that is, keep our eyes open, to what happens in our life right now. So when I'm kind and considerate, what happens? And we might say, well, I'm kind to so-and-so and they're not kind to me back, so karma doesn't really work. Then we start to pay even closer attention. That's just looking outwards. When I really want to focus on what's happening in terms of cause and effect, I notice when I'm kind, what does it do to my own mind in that moment that I'm kind? Instead of looking out at what I get back from that other person, I notice that it has a positive impact on my own mind. And that's where I start to see cause and effect. And then I start to understand that to change reactions or conditions out there takes more than just one go. It takes practice and it takes repeating the same thing until that other person may change. But if I keep practicing the kindness, I'll certainly feel happier. And that happiness will mean that I'm already getting something back. I take that happiness with me to my next moment and to my next moment and to my next moment. So we investigate the law of cause and effect right now in our own life. And if we keep on doing that, we will start to see that it's the truth. And then we may start to be able to see it in terms of karma playing itself out, and also understand how rebirth happens, because the mind is arising and passing away, being affected by causes and conditions produced in each moment. And then we can start to at least approach the idea of what rebirth is about, because we see it happening moment by moment throughout this life itself. So I think that might be enough. So we'll finish by paying homage to the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha. Patipanno.
Namah.